So tonight we are kicking off our new series for this autumn block of Sunday evenings. And it's really a continuation in Luke's Gospel. We did the first part of this incredible account of the life of Jesus, chapters 1 to 5. But I guess some of you either weren't here for that series, or even if you were, you won't necessarily remember every last bit. So I want to get you back into what's going on in the section we pick up this evening. From the middle of chapter 5, we've entered a verbal war zone in the story. Jesus has found himself again and again and again on the receiving end of a verbal onslaught from the religious leaders of the day. And the reason that we're seeing sparks fly in this section is quite simple. It's because we're seeing what happens when Jesus meets religion. We're seeing that fireworks happen when religion comes up against Jesus. If you've got your Bible still open at that page, you'll see that it all kicks off in chapter 5, verse 21. Jesus there had made the outrageous claim that he is the one who can forgive sins. And the Pharisees are inwardly are going nuts at this man who dares to speak blasphemy. And then clash number 2 happens in verse 30. We see there the Pharisees complaining to Jesus' disciples, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" So Jesus has had the audacity to associate with a tax collector. A guy called Levi, who is the very definition of a moral outcast in their society. And the Pharisees are furious. "Why are you spending time with people like him?" And then clash number 3 lands in verse 33. They, the Pharisees, said to him, that's Jesus, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." So again and again and again, Jesus is breaking the mold. He is not conforming to the rules. And as they clash, the tension levels are mounting. It's Jesus versus religion. And as we break into chapter 6 tonight, Luke is continuing to confront us with this theme. As he's unpacking for us, he's putting before us this person of Jesus and wanting us to see who he is. And he does so by placing two very similar events side by side. And I want us to see tonight something that is the strand really that runs through all of this. These events are about rest. They're about rest. And not just the kind of rest that we need, the kind of rest that we get when we sleep, when we take a break, when we take time off, but the deeper kind of soul rest that we're all searching for. I guess some of you have seen the classic boxing movie, Rocky. Some of you have seen Rocky? They went a bit downhill when they persisted with all the sequels, and they ended up with Rocky 10 or something. And if you saw it, Rocky was about 83 years old and still making a comeback. But the first one was great. And there's a point in the film where Rocky is obsessively training. And he's running up and down and up and down and up and down the Philadelphia steps. And he's just committed obsessively to what he's doing. And his girlfriend asks him, "Why is it so important for you to go the distance in the ring? Why are you so obsessed?" And his answer is simple. "Then I'll know I'm not a bum. Then I'll know I'm not a bum." In other words, Rocky was searching for rest. He wanted to know that he was okay. He wanted to know that he mattered. He wanted to know that he was approved. We all want rest. And that's what these episodes are all about. So we're going to see, firstly, the burden of restlessness. And then the source of true rest and the cost of true rest. So here we go with the first one, the burden of restlessness. The really important thing about these two episodes is that they both take place on the Sabbath. So chapter 6, verse 1, Luke flags that up, one Sabbath. And verse 6, the second episode, on another Sabbath. That's the really important bit. Now in the first incident, what happens is that Luke tells us Jesus is going through some cornfields with his disciples, and his disciples do something that seems really ordinary and and quite innocent to us. Verse 1, they begin to pick some ears of corn, rub them in their hands, and eat the grain. Now, I didn't see any of you go into uproar when you read that they'd done that. You know, nobody's walking out with fury. But that is exactly the response it generated among the Pharisees, these religious leaders of the day. Look at verse 2. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" So here's clash number 4. But why? What's the issue that's happening here? Well, back in the Old Testament law, and the law God gave to his people Israel, in amongst the Ten Commandments, chapter 20, verse 8 of Exodus, God gives to the people the provision of the Sabbath day. It was a day every week on which they were to rest, to stop their work, to worship. But as you go on through Israel's history, and by the time you get to Jesus' day that we're reading about here, the religious leaders had surrounded and ring-fenced that Sabbath command with this list of specific regulations. So they put in place 39 types of activity that you were not to do on the Sabbath day, one of which was reaping grain, the crime of crimes. And so, as the Pharisees are here on this Sabbath day, and they look out and they see Jesus' disciples doing that very thing, in their view, this is a deeply, deeply serious breach of the religious law. It's episode 1. Now look on to the second episode, and you've got a pretty similar thing. Again, there's a presenting issue, which comes in verse 6. Now, on another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. And again, there's an accusation, although this time Jesus intercepts it before it even gets voiced. Look at verse 7. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. So what's the problem this time? Well, another one of these 39 regulations contained instruction about this kind of situation as well. It was deemed to be acceptable only to heal or to step in with medical intervention if a person's need was life or death. So let's say someone had fallen and cut a major artery and there's blood shooting 35 feet across the room and they're minutes away from bleeding to death. It was okay as the good and righteous people of God to step in and give medical assistance. Wasn't that good? They didn't bleed to death. That's great. But if not, if maybe a limb was hanging off but they could survive until morning, you couldn't step in. You left them with their limb barely attached. And it's with that idea in view that the Pharisees are lying in wait. They're licking their lips here. All of the ingredients are in the pot for them. Jesus, a Sabbath day, a synagogue, and a man just desperate to be healed. Now here's the thing as we read this. I know what we're like. We're all inwardly dismissing and mocking the Pharisees, aren't we? We're laughing at these guys as the idiotic, stupid villains of the piece. But before we're too quick to pounce, we need to think about what's going on in their hearts that led them to respond in this way. And quite simply, it was that they were trying to earn their own rest. This deep-seated rest that comes when you know you're okay, you know you're accepted, you know you're good enough. They were trying to earn it themselves through religion. So for the Pharisees, their thought process went something like this. If I follow the right steps, if I go through the correct procedure and code of conduct, God will approve of me. God will accept me. It boils really down to this. If I perform, then I'm accepted. And that's why it had come to this. All the regulations, all the ring fencing. I must make sure that I perform because that is how I know I'm okay. That's how I know I'm good enough. It's how I rest. But you know, it never works. It never works. When you're relying on your own performance to get rest, it never works. Because you never know if you've done enough. And I think there are two marks that we find in this passage that show us what it looks like if you are relying on your own performance. The first is that your focus will be on the letter, not the spirit of the law. Your focus will be on the letter and not the spirit of the law. What do I mean? Well, let me show you. If you look into verses 3 and 4, we get a reply from Jesus to their challenge that the Pharisees just don't know what to do with. They've got no category for this. Jesus takes them back to an incident from the life of their greatest king, King David. If you want to read more about it, it's in 1 Samuel 21. But basically, in the story that happens, David comes to the tabernacle, and he's got with him a band of men that are with him on a mission. And just like any group of guys, they're hungry. And the problem is that the only bread available to them is the consecrated bread. So this is bread in their religious life that was set apart for the priests, only for them as a food offering. That's the only bread that's there. But because there's no other bread, David and the guys tuck in. Now, by the letter of the law, that was unlawful. And yet nowhere are they condemned by God in the whole of the Old Testament scriptures. And neither does Jesus condemn their actions here. In fact, quite the opposite. Why not? Well, because Jesus knows what the heart of the law is all about. It's about loving God and loving others. We know it well, many of us, I guess, when Jesus is challenged or asked, what is the greatest commandment? He says, it is this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind and your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. But you know, that heart of the law, that spirit of the law, is the bit that gets lost when you're trying to earn your own approval and your own rest. In the book King's Cross by Tim Keller, he talks about a conversation that he had once with a woman who came to him after he'd been preaching on that verse, love your neighbor as yourself. And she came to him and she said this, firstly, I want to know exactly who my neighbor is. It can't be everybody in the world. I could never do that. So what number of blocks around my house does my neighbor mean? Does this Bible rule cover? And then she went on and she said, I want to know as well exactly what I have to do. What are the things I have to do for my neighbor to love them as myself? And in the book, as he reflects on that conversation, Tim Keller writes this. Do you hear the anxiety in her questions? She was not a self-righteous, morally arrogant person. But because she was not awash in the love and acceptance of God through Jesus Christ, for her, the purpose of the law was to assure her that God had to see her and so treat her as a good person. She didn't have the emotional security to handle a law that uses broad strokes to paint a life of love and obedience. She wanted to narrow it down, detail it out, button it up, so that she could feel good about herself when she complied. We are all susceptible to this anxiety, though some of us have learned to hide it better than she could. You see what he's saying? When you're trying to earn your own rest, when you're trying to know that you are okay with God through your own performance, you cannot deal with the spirit of the law. You don't want broad brushstrokes. You don't want this open remit to love and obey. You demand details. You need specific regulations. You need 39 detailed do's and don'ts about what you can do on a Sabbath day. You need everything boxed off neatly. You must do this, you mustn't wear that, you must go there, you mustn't read this, you must watch that, and so on and so on. Because only when you've got all the detailed rules can you be sure you're getting it right and that you're going to be accepted. But it loses sight, complete sight of the heart of the law, loving God and loving others. That's one mark. The other mark is that you focus on rules and not people. You know, it's really striking, quite alarmingly so, what the Pharisees would have preferred to see happen here. Think about what they wanted. In episode 1, they would have preferred to see the disciples go home hungry. In episode 2, they would prefer to have seen the man go home unhealed. It didn't matter to them that men who needed food would go home starving. It didn't matter to them that a needy man with the burden of a physical ailment would go home just the way he was, as long as the regulations were kept. Isn't that incredible? It is the ultimate case of losing the wood for the trees. They've got no clue. They're so lost in their self-centered obsession with earning God's approval through rules. They've got no perspective at all on God's priorities. And yet again, can't we be just the same? More caught up in seeing rules adhered to than people loved and cared for. We can be judgmental about the behavior of other people, sticklers for our lists of do's and don'ts, but cold-hearted about their needs. I want you to see where this burden of restlessness leaves you. It leaves you like these Pharisees, anxious, uptight, inflexible, graceless, and restless, because you're carrying the burden yourself of your need to be approved, your need to know you're okay. So what you need, what I need, what we all need is the source of true rest. In this first episode, when Jesus responds to the Pharisees, in verse 5, he says something stunning, and it's the heart of this section. Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man," it's a reference to himself, "is Lord of the Sabbath." Now, for us to understand and feel the full weight of what's going on in that sentence, we need to zoom back and get an understanding on the big picture purpose of the Sabbath. And it all begins right in the beginning. You go to Genesis 1, and there in 6 days, God has created the world. And as Genesis 2 begins, we read this. "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, he rested from all the work of creating that he had done." So day 7 comes. God rests. Now, why did he do that? Was he tired? You know, had all that creating and flinging stars into space just taken it out of him? Of course not. Through the creation account, we read again and again this phrase, "God saw what he had made, and it was good." And then we get to the pinnacle of the creation, which is humankind in the image of God. And then God looks at what he's made and he says, "It is very good." And then he rests. It's a deep satisfaction. It's a deep enjoyment. It's a deep pleasure. It is finished. Deep rest. And you know, in God's intentions, in the story that would have been, had nothing gone wrong, humankind would have lived forever in the rest of God. Satisfied, no stirring in the soul, no need to try and fill this need for acceptance and approval. It would be ours. But it did go wrong. We turn our backs on God, sin enters, and this Sabbath rest of God is lost. And then you go forward in the story, and God calls a people to himself. And as he gives them this law, which is his way of life for them, that's going to be for their good, their best possible way of life, God imprints into that law a reminder and a foretaste of Sabbath rest. This rest for which they and we are created. And then we fast forward a long way, and in the book of Hebrews, we read something mind-blowing. And I want you to turn to this one if you've got a Bible open. Hebrews chapter 4, page 1203. These are incredible verses. I've read them, I don't know how many times before, but in the light of this passage in Luke, I think they really, really, well, they blew me away. And I hope they do you as we read them. Chapter 4, Hebrews, verses 9 and 10. The writer says, "There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. What is it saying? It's saying nothing less than this. It is possible for us to regain the lost Sabbath rest of God. This deep rest that we need, that we're searching for. A rest that means you can lay down your striving. You can rest from your works as God did from his. That's an amazing sentence. Let that sink in. It's describing the offer of a rest that is as deep and as profound as the rest God enjoyed at the moment when he completed and finished his perfect creation. Isn't that amazing? At the finishing of the creation of the world, God rests. And the writer to Hebrews says, there is an offer for you of that kind of rest. How do we get it? We get it through the Lord of the Sabbath. In this episode in Luke 6, Jesus doesn't say to the Pharisees, I am Lord over the Sabbath. And that would be a massive claim in and of itself if he'd said that. But Jesus isn't just saying, I've got authority over the Sabbath, so I've got a right to do this. He isn't just saying, I've got the right to define the Sabbath. He's saying, I am the Sabbath rest of God. I am the rest to which the Sabbath day has pointed. Elsewhere, he puts it this way, come to me, all of you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. How can you rest from your works? The only way you can rest is when you no longer base your approval and your acceptance on your works. And instead, you base them on Jesus' finished work. Listen to one other little quote from King's Cross, the book I mentioned earlier. At the end of his great act of creation, the Lord said, it is finished, and he could rest. On the cross, at the end of his great act of redemption, Jesus said, it is finished, and we can rest. On the cross, Jesus was saying of the work underneath your work, the work that makes you truly weary, this need to prove yourself because who you are and what you do are never good enough. Jesus is saying, that is finished. I guess many of you know or have seen the famous film, Chariots of Fire. It's a film that is about the Paris Olympics of 1924. And it brilliantly portrays a contrast between two Olympians, Harold Abrahams and Eric Liddell. And at one point in the film, when talking about the 100-meter sprint that he would do long before Usain Bolt had ever even been born, Harold Abrahams said this, I've got 10 seconds to justify my existence. I've got 10 seconds to justify my existence. What's going on in Harold Abrahams? It's a guy weighed down by the burden of restlessness. A guy burdened by the work of self-justification. He's saying, look, only out there when I achieve on the track will I prove to myself and to anyone and everyone else that I'm worth something. If I perform enough, if I do enough, if I complete enough, I'm okay. I'll matter, I'll have rest. But if I don't, I've got nothing. But Eric Liddell, a Christian who at the time opted that he wouldn't compete on a Sunday, was different. And he said this to his sister, God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. Isn't that a contrast? I've got 10 seconds to justify my very existence. God made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. He'd found true rest. Well, Abraham's needed to keep striving, keep doing, keep proving. He needed to know he was good enough. And he lived and he ran loaded under that burden. But Eric Liddell knew that through the Lord of the Sabbath, he was already good enough. He was already accepted and it changed everything. He meant that for him, his work, his running was liberated. He ran with freedom and he ran with the love and acceptance of God shining in his face. So what is it for you? What are you looking for rest? What are you looking for to know that you're okay? Is it your own performance? Is it your moral goodness? Is it your keeping of the rules? Is it your achievements in life? Is it the abilities that you've got? Is it your accomplishments? Is it your job satisfaction? Is it your family? Is it your children? Only the Lord of the Sabbath can give to you a rest that is the rest you need, a rest that starts now, and even more than that, a rest that will be one day experienced in all its fullness. Now, I love the response of Jesus in the second episode. In verse 8, have a look at it. He sets up the stage. He knows what the resentful Pharisees are thinking. And he sets it up. Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." So he got up and stood there. Can you imagine the tension in the room? What's he going to do? And then Jesus poses a typically brilliant question, verse 9. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it?" And his opponents are left speechless. They're floored by the power of Jesus' words. And then he does this in verse 10. He looked round at them all and then said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was completely restored. Why does Jesus deliberately take it to them? It's because he wants to show what it means for him to be the Lord of the Sabbath. They'd completely lost sight of it, but the Sabbath had always been about restoration. It had been about replenishment. It had been about repairing the broken. And that's why the Pharisees' mindset is so desperately wrong here. Because healing this man, transforming this man, is the very thing the Sabbath was meant to be all about. There is nothing more fitting that could have been done on the day of the Sabbath than for the Lord of the Sabbath to restore. And in doing so, he's pointing us to what he's going to do completely one day. When he returns to usher in this eternal Sabbath rest that we read about in Hebrews. Because on that day, the Lord of the Sabbath will restore and replenish and repair finally and deeply and permanently. He'll reach into the hearts of everyone who belongs to him. And every disappointment and every hurt will be repaired. He will reach into the bodies of everyone who belongs to him. And every blemish and every ache and every disease will be gone. And he will put his hand on the cheek of everyone who is his. And every tear will be wiped away. If you are his, you will be restored. You'll be replenished. You will be repaired. You will know rest. Isn't that amazing? But for him to offer you that rest, it cost him everything. So we're going to end with the cost of this true rest. I think the end of this section is so tragic. It's so tragic. They've been looking for a reason to accuse. Jesus does this beautiful thing, this fitting thing. But they're so hard-hearted that they cannot deal with Jesus. These claims to forgive sin, his insistence on mixing with the immoral, he's breaking the mold when it comes to the rules. And now this astronomical declaration that he is the Lord of the Sabbath is the last straw. He threatens their system. He threatens their way of life. He threatens their religion. And there is but one solution. Kill him. They were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. And kill him they did. And there's a phrase that's found its way into common usage. There's no rest for the wicked. You heard that? There's no rest for the wicked. But unbeknown to many people, it's got its roots in the Bible. Isaiah 57, verse 20. "But the wicked are like the tossing sea which cannot rest, whose waves cast up mire and mud. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked." The wicked cannot rest. Jesus is the only person who has ever lived who doesn't come into that category. The only one whose life was a full and complete obedience to the will of God. And that means Jesus is the only one who deserved rest. And yet the Pharisees conspire to put him to death. And later he will hang on a cross. And explaining that in 2 Corinthians 5, Paul writes this: "God made him who had no sin, to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. What does that mean? It means that on the cross, God placed all our wickedness on Jesus. God made Jesus, counted Jesus as wicked. He became sin for us. And so that means that on the cross, Jesus experienced the full burden of our restlessness. As he was counted wicked, he endured restlessness beyond our imagination, so that we could be granted the rest we long for. So that we could hear those words, "It's finished. It's finished. The work is complete. Everything that needs to be done for you to be okay, it's done." And so now the God of the universe can look down at you. And he can do so with approval and with acceptance. And he can say to you, "You are my beloved child. In you I am well pleased." Jesus is the only true source of the rest we need. But it cost him the full eternal burden of our restlessness. Let me end with a little quote from a sermon Dick Lucas once preached. He imagined a conversation between an early Christian in Rome and her neighbour, a little chat over the garden fence. "Ah," the neighbour says, "I hear you are religious. Great, religion is a good thing. Where is your temple or holy place?" "We don't have a temple," replies the Christian. "Jesus is our temple." "No temple, but where do your priests work and do their rituals?" "We don't have priests to mediate the presence of God," replies the Christian. "Jesus is our priest." "No priest, but where do you offer your sacrifices to earn the favor of your God?" "We don't need a sacrifice," replies the Christian. "Jesus is our sacrifice." "What kind of religion is this?" exclaims the neighbor. And the answer is, it's no kind of a religion at all.